this week on Commons People.
In the course of the next 12 months, we will be looking for a new leader.
How long will Theresa May survive?
As the government has previously said, these are matters that the Assembly, were it to be functioning, should be able to act upon.
Will Northern Ireland liberalise abortion law?
For Mr Speaker, the charges against him he's denied, that's a matter that will be separately dealt with.
And how much trouble is John Bercow in over bullying allegations? Hello and welcome to Commons People, HuffPost's politics podcast. This week I'm joined by Paul Waugh, as always. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Ned.
And Rachel Wearmouth. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
So this week was supposed to be, again, the end of the road for Theresa May, but she survived spectacularly after giving an emotional plea to Tory MPs to back her Brexit plan last night at the 1922 committee. Not that she's necessarily safe forever. Here's Nicky Morgan predicting how long she'll last.
Theresa May, she got your backing? Well, she has absolutely for now, but I do
next
think
October.
That probably, I think we'll probably, in the course of the next 12 months, we will be looking for a new leader.
Okay, putting yourself forward?
No.
So May has also now apparently set a date of mid-November when she'll have to sort of start preparing properly for a no deal. Paul, like, what preparations are now happening? What's kind of stepped up this week that we learned we didn't know last week?
Well, what's new is that we learned on Tuesday that the Cabinet have now agreed they're going to have weekly updates on no deal preparation. Until this point, it's always been sort of roughly every 6 weeks, maybe every few other weeks, but it's going to be every week. Now, number 10, we're quite clear, this isn't just no deal preparation they're going to be updated on, it's deal preparation as well.
Isn't it a bit bad that they just now are doing weekly Brexit at the Cabinet?
But isn't that quite strange? It just shows it's dominating everything. But also, so there's that bit, which is a weekly update. Now, they say they're always going to sort of step up the pace in terms of that. You might say, is it a bluff to Brussels, all this? Mm. Or is it real? Is it really them being worried and admitting that actually if Brussels dig in and if we dig in on Northern Ireland, without going into the detail of it, but if we dig in on Northern Ireland and there's no resolution, then no deal is a credible outcome, or rather a plausible outcome. So there's the weekly updates, but there's also, we're finding out that actually there's this idea that from mid-November, all domestic legislation could be put to one side and we could have this rolling programme of no deal legislation, because you do need lots and lots of bits in place if you are going to leave with no deal. And we're going to have a story up later about some of the statutory instruments that the government is actually going to have to step up in order to literally leave on the right terms.
Is there enough time for MPs to re-scrutinise all of this, though? It's not too long until exit day in March, and there must be so many bits.
That's it. It's a massive rush, and there's going to be a huge amount of legislation. There's even talk that actually there's so much that they're going to have to shorten the Christmas break. They'll all hate that. They'll certainly have to shorten maybe the February half-term break, so just literally to have enough time to look at all this stuff.
And I guess one of the things I've thought about is a lot of the focus will surely shift on how the EU are going to react to all of that pressure here as well. If it's kind of, are they willing to let us leave without a deal, or is there some flexibility there? I think Keir Starmer, quite interestingly, on the Andrew Marr show, seemed to think that there was.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because that, you know, Starmer has been in close contact with Brussels without sort of looking treacherous or working for the other side. They've got channels of communication open quite intensively, and I think that was significant. And certainly no deal is not what Europe wants either, don't forget.
Do you think there's a chance that it kind of gains momentum, though, once the kind of these proper plans start happening, legislation stuff, does it gain a life of its own? And by the process of preparing, you end up becoming that's
well, self-fulfilling prophecy
exactly.
is part of the problem. I mean, one, the other thing that happened at Cabinet is there was this really scary moment where Transport Secretary Chris Grayling, who's scary most of the time, actually came up with this idea that the government in extremis, in a no-deal scenario, if things really fell apart for the French at the Calais port, that actually we would have to start thinking about commandeering freight ships to import emergency supplies of food and medicine. Now, it all sounds a bit mad, but the fact is they're actually physically getting civil servants to write down these contingency plans. And even this morning in Brexit questions, Dominic Raab said, any blockage at the border should be dealt with pragmatism on both sides, and it can be alleviated. He said, we need to make sure we're in a position, regardless of what the EU or the French does, that were able to weather any short-term disruption. Now, that's key, the French. So they keep basically, they know that the French are ones playing hardball most in Europe. And so this is a threat to the French. Look, all right, if you really want to play hardball, we can play hardball. And so Raab said, actually, he said, not only do we want to make sure we have the money and investment in place to deal with this, but we've got cooperation with business and port authorities, not just in UK, but in Belgium and the Netherlands. Now, he was basically saying, we'll move, instead of, we'll screw Calais, we'll do it all through Rotterdam, or we'll, you know, or we'll go through Ostend. And you just think, really? Are you really going to do that?
Do you think there's also a chance of them, if in doubt, blame the French? Yeah. It's kind of the Iraq war again, when, you know, blame France for not getting the resolution through, because that always goes down well with the people. Well, Do it again this time.
It's a default Tory position, don't forget, blaming the French. It's a default
British position, isn't it?
Well, it often can be. There's a sort of I don't know, public school-y sort of hatred of the French from many, many years, and it's definitely embedded in the Tory party.
So, what it also does as well is this continuous talk of no deal puts a lot of pressure on those Labour MPs who are considering backing May's deal, should she manage to achieve one. This really will focus minds, I think.
Yeah, and that's why it's quite canny. If you've got people like Caroline Flint, who this week made clear that she thought that she wasn't alone, that there could be 45 MPs like her who would rather have a deal, any deal, than no deal, then all this talk about no deal is actually quite effective.
Yeah, where are, do we think, on that number of Labour MPs that would vote for May's deal rather than no deal? Because before it was said up to 30, do you think... And at the time, actually, some people said that's rubbish, it won't be that many. Do you think actually now it's more and more likely to be?
Well, I spoke to some people from TSSA, the union, this week, and Hope Not Hate this week, and they seem to think the figure's somewhere between 40 and 50. Wow. And they're considering doing, they are going to do some organising within those constituencies to try and get more of the Remain vote out and put pressure on the MPs, write to them, tell them that, you know, they can't back this.
To vote against the deal, with the goal of forcing a referendum
forcing a people's vote,
it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, that's where we are. The parliamentary arithmetic is still really, really difficult. But the Prime Minister does have this weight of, you know, the inexorable logic towards, look, it's only really going to be my deal or no deal. Yeah. And that's...
Let's talk about the Prime Minister, actually. You know, we had, from Sunday through the start of the week, all this talk about 48 letters. Are they in? Are they not in? Is there more? Is there less? Will she survive? She seems pretty strong position now after that meeting last night, Paul.
Less? You mean fewer, don't you?
Well, very good.
Okay.
Well, it's certainly true that last night I was like lots of hacks. I was outside that room last night and getting texts from within it. And there was a sort of genuine sort of sense that, look, let's give her a fair wind. And the fact that she made an emotional plea, you know, look, like, this is really isn't about me, but this is really, you know, it's high stakes. I'm representing the country. I need all your support, kind of thing. That kind of worked, and Amber Rudd was quite effective afterwards in sort of spinning for her. Yet again, just as Amber Rudd stepped in during the general election for the debate that Theresa May never turned up for, you know, Amber Rudd often stepping up to the plate for the PM. And I don't think that goes unnoticed, shall we say, when it comes to leadership stakes. So there's an interesting element there. But also, that's all true, but the Brexiteers that I've talked to and the critics who aren't even Brexiteers of the PM, who are determined to get rid of her, are now drawing up quite detailed wargaming plans. I mean, I will talk to one of them, and they said, look, we can do this in 2.5 weeks, a leadership contest, and it will only take 2 days to do the vote of confidence before that. So you're roughly looking at 3 weeks altogether. And they've gone into such detail. They say that in the first week, we'll have a rolling series of hustings for the MPs. We'll narrow it down to two within 1 week. Then the two people will go out to the country, and we'll have a series of national hustings, which will only last a few days. They'll have one in Scotland, Wales, three in England. And they've gone into that kind of detail. And then it'll be put out to an email or a postal ballot vote, which will literally take, I think, about 4 days. So they've wargamed it all. Now, the reason they've done that is because they say this is a key moment, the only moment which to do it, because they think negotiations have stalled with Brussels. And because they've stalled with Brussels, they think they've got this three-week gap in which to actually get rid of May, come back with a new leader who says, right, we're going to reset relations with you, Brussels. It's going to be tougher. We're going to have a free trade agreement. We're going to try and sort out something on Northern Ireland. That's it. Take it or leave it. And they think that'll be a very strong position. But who knows?
The message in coming out of that cabinet meeting was just also sunshine and lollipops, though, wasn't it? It was just like, everything is fine. Everything is awesome when you're part of a team. It just seemed a little bit too rosy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So speaking of May and how long she's been Tory leader, we'll do a quiz.
Ah.
I'm sure you'd be glad to hear. It's about the length people have been Tory leaders.
Okay.
So Theresa May became Tory leader on the 11th of July, 2016. She's been Tory leader for 836 days. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you some Conservative Party leaders. I want you to tell me if they were Tory leader for longer than May has been or shorter period of time than May has been. I haven't got a clever name for it because I couldn't really work one out. So, for example, Ian Duncan Smith.
Ooh, that's a tough one because she's been there roughly 2 and a bit years. He was there roughly 2 and a bit years.
I'm going to go shorter.
That's really tough. He was there from 2001 to 2003. I'm going to say narrowly less than May.
Yeah, 784. So only just a little bit less, but really, really close.
Yeah.
What about, this is another really close one, Michael Howard.
That's close again, because he's 2003 to 2005. I think she's been leader longer than Michael
I think he
Howard.
Will have been leader longer.
He was leader for 761. So May, just a bit longer than him as well.
Wow. So she's past the May.
Yeah.
She's past the Duncan Smith and the Howard landmarks. That's interesting.
Okay, what about Neville Chamberlain?
God.
Shorter.
So May's been shorter.
Chamberlain shorter.
I'm going to say Chamberlain was longer than May.
Yeah, he was leader for 1,231 days.
Not much longer.
Between May 1937 and October 1940. How about Stanley Baldwin?
God, you're testing us now, Ned.
Yep.
I Stanley do Baldwin. Not know.
I think he'll be longer than May.
I'm going to copy off Paul.
Yeah, it's so much longer, like 5,120 days. Yeah. So he's around forever. Okay,
he was Cameron's role model, by the way.
Yeah.
There you go.
And one last one. Anthony Eden.
Eden. Everyone's racking their brains when they're watching The Crown. Anthony Eden. Less than May. Let me say less than May.
I'm going to go longer than May, just to be contrary.
Less, 642. Oh, yes. So not very long at all. That was 21st of April 1955 until 22nd of January 1957.
And you're all going to say, yeah, you were alive then, Paul, aren't you?
Yeah, well, you said it for us. We don't have to. Like,
if you do it
yourself, then we don't have to.
For the record.
So that was
I'm a
quiz.
World Cup baby.
So, you know, it's the usual high standards. And there's actually been a lot of other non-Brexit stuff this week, surprisingly, for once, which is quite interesting.
God.
This one still involves Northern Ireland, though, of course. Mm-hmm. So this week, MPs moved to try and put pressure on reforming abortion and gay marriage laws in Northern Ireland. It was Stella Creasy and Conor McGinn who put down an amendment to the Northern Ireland Bill. Here's Creasy speaking in the Commons last night about what she was doing.
Now, absolutely. As the government has previously said, these are matters that the Assembly, were it to be functioning, should be able to act upon. But as we said at the start, this bill is a recognition that that Assembly is not functioning and unlikely to be functioning soon. So what then, is the human question, do women like Sarah Ewart do? What then do people who love each other do? When their politicians fail them, then what do the public do?
So, Paul, what happened and does this put any pressure on the government to actually change abortion law and gay marriage laws in Northern Ireland, or is it really kind of symbolic?
Well, what was symbolic was earlier in the week was a 10-minute rule bill by Labour MP Diana Johnson, who wanted to decriminalise and change the law in Northern Ireland. That was a very much clearer legislative move. But it was a symbolic one. 10-minute rule bills never go anywhere. So, but it passed, but it doesn't really mean anything. The reason this was worded differently and more vaguely was because it's actually about a piece of legislation, the Northern Ireland Bill, which is needed to try and set up as a sort of prelude to setting up the Northern Ireland Assembly and encourage the politicians there to get back to normal. So Creasy did what she's very good at. She's very clever at using parliamentary procedure and wording an amendment to get not just the approval of the clerk. So it's got to be in order, point one. It's got to get likely to be selected by the speaker, point two. But more than that, it's got to build a sort of cross-party coalition to get it through. And on all those three counts this week, she really scored. because she worded this to ensure that actually they're not overnight going to be in change to a Northern Ireland abortion law. But what she's said in this specific amendment is that government officials, while the Northern Ireland Assembly is not sitting, it's Northern Ireland is being run by unelected officials. And those officials should now be directed by the Secretary of State in London to take into account human rights legislation when they're dealing with abortion or same-sex marriage. So it in the real world, those unelected officials will be very cognizant of what the politicians are doing in Northern Ireland, particularly the DUP, and won't, let's be honest, won't want to countermand them. They're unelected. But it's still symbolic, but also it's in statute that now it will have to be taken into account, the fact that human rights apply not just to Scotland, England and Wales, but they apply also to Northern Ireland. And it's a human rights issue, the idea of abortion and same-sex marriage. And that's why it was significant, because it got that into statute.
And it got a lot of Tories on board, didn't it? Penny Mordaunt.
I was going to say Penny Mordaunt, Greg Clark.
Yeah.
It shows like a real split at the heart of government there as well. So it's a real headache for May, and obviously she doesn't want to make the DUP any more bloody minded.
Well, the curious thing one as well. I mean, and the Speaker has announced this morning that there was something wrong with the actual the electronic recording of the vote. Because maybe, just maybe, Gavin Williamson didn't vote for this move, because he was the other cabinet minister that we learned last night had voted for the Stella Creasy Amendment. And I was really surprised. Gavin Williamson, the best friend of the DUP? Really
yeah, that did seem really weird.
Now, but maybe it is, because it's a matter of conscience. Maybe that's absolutely fine. But there are other ministers as well that, you know, there are lots of the people you'd expect. Alastair Burt, there was Margot James, lots of junior ministers or ministers of state also back this move. And it shows you, and Anne Milton, the health minister, Caroline Dynage, the health minister, shows you that actually there is a weight of opinion within the Tory party that says, hold on a tick, we know we've got this alliance with the DUP, but actually we really do believe in women's rights, we believe in gay rights, and the Tory party should stand for those. And I thought it was quite symbolic that you've got cabinet ministers standing up and saying
Perhaps particularly ones that look into the future, not just the immediate DUP situation as well.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget as well, fair play to, it wasn't just Stella Creasy, it was Conor McGinn, we should stress as well. And I think the fact that the two of them were doing this really helped them galvanise as much cross-party opinion as possible, because they're, you know, both well-liked by different bits of the Tory party. But again, to be fair to Creasy, you know, this is yet another example where she's made a change. You know, Loan Sharks, Wonga's gone out of business because of her Loan Sharks campaign through legislation. She's already granted to women in Northern Ireland the chance of coming over to have at least a free NHS abortion over here.
Yeah, she amended the Queen's speech, didn't she?
By amending the Queen's speech. Again, another clever procedural move. And crucially, this week, the Labour Party whips and the Labour Party, the leader's office, turned behind this campaign in the middle of the week as well. They rode in behind it. So it's just, people might think, well, why isn't Stella Creasy in the shadow cabinet? Why isn't she actually
doesn't
being,
need to be, does she?
You know, and that's the point. She doesn't need to be. As a backbencher, she's showing that. And it, for all politics students out there, when you're doing your little, you know, your GCSE or A level or even your degree, and you're told, what can a backbencher do on their own if you're not in government? Stella Creasy is a great role model.
Yeah, she's also sort of rebuilding a bit of the Blairite wing of the party, isn't she? She's starting to actually take action, which is a criticism that's often thrown at that side of the party at the moment, is that they're not doing anything and they don't have any ideas.
Yeah.
As you're saying, we do have ideas and I've got a lot of them.
And I'm doing something about them. Yeah.
I mean, what's significant here, of course, is that her interests in Northern Ireland align very, very closely with the interests of Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, which is that they don't want Northern Ireland to be seen as separate in terms of human rights and gay rights and women's rights. They've got an agenda there. But, you know, it does help.
Yeah, there was also another significant move this week, which was when the House of Commons Commission decided to accept the recommendations of the report into bullying in full. This put some pressure on John Bercow over kind of historical complaints made against him. But like we saw when this started bubbling up, not everyone's against him. And here's John McDonnell on Sky News this morning saying that it would be a cop-out to say Bercow is responsible for fixing kind of all the bullying problems in Parliament.
I think it's up to all of us to try and shift the responsibility from all of our shoulders onto one man, I think is a cop-out. I think we've all got to sort this out. It isn't just down to one man. I think it's the whole of Parliament. And we should all take responsibility now.
You go after big business. You go after big business. And if there's bad practice at a big business organisation, you would be looking at the top man in charge and asking for him to go, and a whole cultural shift as well. But heads have to roll when serious matters happen.
Does his decision put a lot of pressure on Burko to go sooner than he said he would? He said he'd stand down in June next year. Does the fact now the rules have changed mean he might be under more stress?
Well, you would certainly think so, but there's a sort of strange thing going on that he seems to have quite a lot of support from Labour MPs. You know, McDonnell's not the first person to come out against him. It seemed that they believe that somehow Brexit and how John Bercow might deal with the Brexit legislation going through Parliament, that kind of trumps some of the alleged bullying that he faces. But I think, on the other hand, you've got to really look at it in a sort of take a few steps back and think, all of these bullying allegations that have gone through Parliament is not, I mean, you know, he really has to consider what he wants.
And that's why
I
think Jess Phillips was significant last weekend, where she came out and said, look, you know, I'm as strongly in favour of John Bercow as anyone else when it comes to him being a reforming speaker and being, you know, on the side of diversity in Parliament and all the good things he's done. But she said she put those things to one side and said, look, actually, this is a different issue. This is about bullying and specific allegations. And, you know, it's about the reform of Parliament and the message sent out that this is a workplace that can't be different from any other workplace. So that's why I think, to answer your question about, you know, will he hang on, kind of. I mean, the problem is the timing of this reform. So this week, it was really significant. House of Commons Commission, which is basically this very secretive, opaque body that doesn't sit, you know, its hearings aren't sort of minuted and they aren't sort of in public, but it's run by the Speaker and senior MPs and it runs the Houses of Parliament. It met this week without him being in the chair, but he was still there, to decide, yeah, we do want a brand new system of grievance for members of staff, whether complaining against the managers or against MPs, make it much more open, and to include, crucially, historical allegations of bullying or harassment. And it's the historical bit that has previously meant that John Bercow has not been investigated, because that's not allowed under the current rules. If it's an old allegation, you can't do it. But they've changed that. The question now is, how quickly can the reform come in? And it's a race against time before he goes next summer. Yeah. You know, I understood that, I'm told that Commons leader Andrea Leadsom, at one point, despite the fact that she's quite strong on a lot of this stuff, felt that it would be too soon to try and rush it all. And she was talking about some kind of 6-month period in which this would take to come in. Within 6 months, he could be gone.
Yeah.
But so there was pushback against that. So there are going to be quicker than that. There's some talk about a sort of preliminary estimate of what's going to happen next before Christmas. Some of the lay members on the commission have said that. If that happens, then we could be looking in the new year when maybe, just maybe, the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards could finally say, right, I'm going to look at all allegations of historical abuse. And then who knows what's going to happen with John Bercow.
And to add to that pressure, I think it's like 4 Tory MPs have resigned from the House of Commons Commission, which in protest. So that adds pressure as well. I mean, it includes Maria Miller, who's...
Yeah, obviously. It was this kind of Commons group on like responsibility and standards.
And that representation.
Representation. So I think it was Will Quince and Main, is that right?
Yeah.
Maria Miller. They quit because Bercow set it up and they kind of thought, well, we don't want to be part of this if he's... I thought also, back to what Labour MPs who sort of support him saying we need him for Brexit, I think Leadsom made a reasonably good point in the Commons last week, I think, when she said, why do you not think the deputy speakers are capable of being fair? It seemed weird...
No, exactly.
Approach. I think that was quite a good point.
It is strange how attached Labour MPs seem to be to Bercow. Like it's almost like there can be no replacement for him at all.
It is strange, but you know they're going to have to. They're already thinking about life after Bercow because you know even if the latest he's going to be there is next summer.
Yeah.
If this is a Parliament goes on to 2022. Who is speaker really matters. And so that's why behind the scenes you're seeing, you know, the jockeying for position for Lindsay Hoyle supporters, Chris Bryant supporters. There's women that want to run for it. So, you know, don't rule out the fact that Labour behind the scenes actually, although they say they want Bercow, are trying to work for who's the successor.
I heard that Alistair Carmichael might consider a position as well, which would be interesting.
There you go.
Well, okay, I think... For 1 week, we're done. Join us next week. See if you've got the same speaker and the same Prime Minister. Who knows?
We might. Bye.
Bye.